can the complexity of life be as simple as doing the right thing for the right people at the right time? You sort of overcomplicate things in business and in life, where it's like, I got to do this, I got to do that, I got to have some, you know, fancy way of communicating, this overcomplicated way of getting clients. But in reality, if you fundamentally invest in the potential of a person without expectation and just try to serve their problem as best you can, you can be one of the top mortgage brokers in the country. So here we are talking to one, according to rankings where they see who is in the top percentage consistently over decades. So apparently, if you do the right thing by people and stay consistent and partner with people that can refer you business, then your business grows. That's the most annoying thing about business is it's the fundamentals. You probably already know how to be successful. You're just not doing it. We've got one of the top 10 producers of mortgage people in all of the land in New Zealand. What's that ranking, by the way? What's it actually, who are you competing against? The world, or is it just like a within the company?
No, it's just within the aggregate, within the group we belong to. So depending on your, you know, what you're doing, what your work that you're producing is, they monitor you and then they allocate different things. So I sit at Premier at the moment, and I've tipped from Premier to Emerging Elite to Elite, and I think it's based on how many settlements you do in a given year. So I've been sitting in that arena for 8 years now.
It's mad. How many people in the comp? 100 people? 10? If you're top 10% of 10.
Yeah, no, we're the biggest aggregate, so it's a few hundred people. So wow. Up and down the country, yeah.
Who's your biggest competition?
Yeah, well, sometimes it was on dollar amount, which isn't necessarily fair, because if you're sitting in a little provincial town like I am, Whangarei, and you think about the prices of homes here compared to Auckland, if it was based on dollar value, it wouldn't be a fair assessment. Mm. So now they look at settlements and things like that. So number of people that you've actually helped, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, how many people is it? What's a good month in settlements? I don't know. Do you have, like, if you've got this aggregate, what's like, what are the different tiers? What, like, if you're doing average, you're getting this many settlements a month, if you're doing good, or is it quarterly, or how do they work it out?
They would work it out within the year, but my focus isn't on settlements. So my focus is 100% customer based. So I enjoy just receiving phone calls from people. In fact, I had some of the most lovely appointments, actually sitting down with people that are fearful. And they're fearful of making the step to becoming a homeowner in the first place. And then you understand their fear or their anxiety. So it could be the commitment, it could be the dollar amount, it could be many things. And then when you understand the fear and you talk to them about that and alleviate the fear, you can see the relief on their faces and then the excitement, because a lot of people, as they get sort of close to middle-aged, are really fearful of taking on that big debt. And I always say to them, well, in my mind, I think we've got to live somewhere. So if we're going to be renting for our life, unless we've saved a massive amount of savings, how are they going to afford that on a pension? You know, and then we go through the choices. Well, do we want to live with our family, our kids? Do we want to move into a retirement village? You know, like, what are our choices as we get older? So in my mind, becoming a homeowner and working towards giving us the freedom of not having a mortgage gives us options in our later years on what we can do and want to do.
I'll be curious about fear, because, you know, a lot of my life was ruled around fear, and probably most people's, and you're quite into that personal development sphere. What do you think fear is? And then also, how do we deal with fear so that we can still do the things we want in life?
In most cases, it's the unknown. It's the unknown. And then when you've got somebody that is fearful of something, you have to honor that, because just because it might not be something I'm fearful of doesn't mean that it's not really relevant to them. So I listen to the fear, and if I consider it, and this is always an opinion, at the end of the day, if I consider it to be unwarranted or unnecessary or unhelpful to them, then I'll talk to them about it. And I always present it, well, I hear you, but what about, you know? And I just present it to them about how I would feel and how else can I actually, you know, because it's really personal when you're talking about stuff like this. And it's a real privilege when somebody comes to me with an application, because they're sharing with me really intimate things, you know, their spending habits, their family makeup, their income, you know, if they've got credit defaults, you know, and they're holding on to stuff like that, just guiding them through it and helping them to overcome things that hold them back.
Have you ever had either a very unusual expense that didn't make sense, or interesting story where you came, maybe not a client, but so you came across someone and they were doing some interesting things and you identified that they're actually having an affair? Or over the years, you must have found yourself in fascinating situations. Do you have any stories or interesting experiences?
Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of things that come across my table. And, you know, I've got a responsibility, actually, if I see things that worry me. So the most worrying, I guess, would be not whether they're having an affair or not, that comes down on their shoulders, but would be something like particularly gambling. And then I look at it and I think, wow, you know, because if you've got something that is an addiction, and it's not something, because recreational spending, we can start and stop, we can make an informed decision, okay, I'm not going to go on holiday, or I'm not going to do whatever. But if it's an addiction, like gambling, then I've got to be really responsible and careful about what I do. And I know I've had somebody come to me that was struggling in business, and they went to Sky City and they spent over $20,000 trying to come up with enough money to pay wages and were unsuccessful.
Oh, God.
And then I needed to, the only way I could make it work would be to do what they call a low doc or a no doc, where you're not presenting bank statements. But because I'd seen it, and because I recognized that it was a problem, I can't not see it. That would make me irresponsible. And it would make me irresponsible not just to the person, but I'm also letting the lender down, because this is a vulnerable person that could also make a decision to gamble rather than paying their home loan. So I've had to walk away from customers and just not do it, because if I don't think it's in their best interest, or if it's something that I have to or would be asked to non-disclose to a bank, there's no way. It's no way. Because if it involves non-disclosure, if you've got to hide something, there's something wrong. So then you walk away.
I think a lot about addiction, weed I was addicted to when I was a hippie living in a tent. And my father's a big gambler and a drinker too. So mum always told me, she's like, oh, you know, you've got an addictive personality, you got to be careful. So I don't drink or do anything for a long time now. And I wonder what it is. And it's very rarely the substance. It's very rarely the gambling. It's very rarely the thing or the action. People say, oh, this is more addictive than this. And I'm like, I think the most addictive thing about it is the emotions that you haven't faced. You know, it's the ability. Like someone said to me, gambling's like gambling on others because you can't gamble on yourself to pursue what you want from life. What do you think addiction is, or what do you think causes that?
I don't know would be my honest answer. And I think that could be individual for every person. It could be a life event that's rocked them or knocked them. It could be a perception of themselves. So our personality is effectively the way we perceive life, isn't it? And, you know, their perception could have been skewed from an event. Usually it's, in my mind, it would be a wound or something that's formed some sort of lack in their life, because otherwise they wouldn't need it.
Mm.
They'd be able to use something, you know, more fulfilling to fulfill themselves.
What do you think on the fulfilling opinion. On the fulfilling part? Because that's my life mission, is to help people live fulfilling lives. I only started this company just to learn how to market, no other reason. Mm-hmm. Just whatever I need to sell that's good enough to help people as well while I'm learning. So fulfillment, what do you think are the pillars of helping live a fulfilling life? What do you think has been helpful in your life to help you, I guess, feel engaged and interested and happy and fulfilled? Maybe not always happy, but content.
I think it would be taking enough time to sit with yourself and to understand the things that make you happy, and to also try to work towards freeing yourself, because I think a lot of people get bogged down by what they perceive they should be. So then they have personas that they build up because they think this is how they should be presenting themselves to the world. And I think to work on yourself to a place, to bring yourself to a place where you feel comfortable in your own skin and confident. And I know a lot of old school teaching, when they're talking about profession, they ask a question: what do you like? You know, what things bring you fulfillment? What fulfillment is joy, isn't it? Like, it's something that you want to do, to get up out of bed in the morning. And when we were going through the level five and we had all these changes in our industry, I watched a lot of people that I'm immensely respectful of fall away because they just didn't want to do it anymore. It was too hard. And it made me realize that what I do as a mortgage broker or a mortgage advisor brings me a lot of fulfillment, because if I can break away fears from people and see them into a home and then see the joy on the other side of it, or I can help young people get into a home. I've had customers come back to me that are passing away and wanting me to help them, you know, with regards to their property and if they're wanting to pass on a legacy to their children. And it's really humbling when you have somebody in all sorts of different situations still regard me as a safe place to come. Because if I hear somebody talking to me about anything and I think it's not in their best interest, then I'm going to say, you know, like, why are you doing this? Because from my perspective, making money out of my business is a result of assisting them or helping them in some way. So if I can't see that my services or my input is helpful, then I shouldn't be in there. It should always be people first. Hey.
Yeah, I mean, it's a better way to do everything. Feels good, gets better results. Mm. Yeah, I think it's kind of akin to, I've been experimenting from a leadership standpoint, the difference between negative reinforcement and positive reinforcement. So the most common management style I see is, when someone does something wrong, you pull them up on it and they correct their behavior pretty quickly. But over the long term, then all that means is you're going to need to require more enforcement in order to get them to do the things you want. And as soon as you're gone, kind of like the dog jumps on the couch, you hit it on the nose and then you leave. As soon as you're not there, it'll jump on the couch again, or it'll lead to 1,000 different behaviors. With positive reinforcement, you don't actually see the benefit initially, where you say each time they do something that's really good, you reward them and celebrate them. And the immediate response is delayed, and then it starts getting better and better. So I think that's the same thing with doing right by people instead of trying to do things transactionally. So it's better for you emotionally. It's better for your life. It's better for your business because the intent comes through. I call it like commission breath. People can smell when you're just trying to explain what's good for you and not good for them. So what's been your, I guess, lessons as you've grown and developed? So when you first came in, you weren't good at this and then you got quite good at it. What was your, what held you back initially? Or you just top 10% producer immediately? What was your...
I would say naivety.
Naivety.
Truly. Because I think in any profession, it doesn't matter what you do, you become better, not just from your successes, but from your failures as well. So you actually need time on the tools. So when I look back at where I started, how is it possible to be good? You know, because you can have all the motivation, you can have all, you know, you can have the qualification, but to understand any profession, you need, it takes time. So I think it's just time on the tools for me, you know, and it's a real appreciation on what I need to do to support and help somebody. It could be as simple as first home buyer come to me and they've got 10% deposit, so I know that I want them to get a building report done. We're going to have to get a registered valuation done. They're probably going to have to spend money on a LIM report, etc. So when I take an application now, I take responsibility for not just providing them with an approval, but managing their cash flow. So I would be wanting to step out to try and get 10 to 15 working days so that I've got time to submit an application, get a response back from a bank, and then have pre-booked valuers and pre-booked builders for as far out as I can so that I'm really concerned about my customers and how much money they spend on stuff, especially if I'm a little bit worried whether or not I'm going to get them over the line. I'd rather put my effort and work in and get them as far as I can. So I guess I take more, I understand the responsibility better.
Mm.
And I also understand how important my diary notes are. So my diary notes tells the story about the person, the situation, and what they're hoping to achieve. So the only way that you can tell a good story is to be a good listener. And then part of creating the story or helping the story unfold, you have to know what questions to ask. So when you're listening to a conversation, you get triggers in your mind and you think, wow, okay, that's like really important. So then I'll go and I'll ask them to explain a wee bit more about something. So it's, I think it's a skill. I think it's a skill to be able to give people the confidence and the trust to be able to open the doors in the first place, let them be vulnerable and talk to me, and then know how to put all that information into a good story. Because the banker, when they receive a piece of paper about a person, they don't know the person, they haven't met the person. So I'm a very good storyteller.
Yeah, I'd be curious. Yeah, it's good to have that confidence. I'd be curious, like, how you structure a story, because, you know, I think for thousands of years, maybe millions of years, maybe not millions, thousands of years, we have passed down knowledge through stories. And you look at some of those powerful content, movies, it's all just storytelling and usually follows a similar journey, the hero's journey. There's a psychologist that studied all these different movies and stories, and it followed a continued theme that people can look at called the hero's journey. But I'd be curious how you apply storytelling in an application. So how do you actually frame it in a tactical sense that helps improve the likelihood of approving a loan, having a happy ending to the once upon a time?
Well, it could be, you know, somebody might have been on JobSeeker or they might have been on ACC. So it's, I would be wanting to know the history, like what have you done before this? So that I can, so I'm thinking about an application while I'm talking to you here and building a story around the person so that the bank understands that this is a time in their life that doesn't represent them as a person, that this is their capacity, this is what they're able to do. So I want to know about, it could be a startup business, and I would be wanting to know where their income streams are coming from. How long have they been doing what they're doing? So they might have just started. I had a customer that had moved up from a different town and had started a new business in a new town, but they had been previously doing the same thing elsewhere. So then it's understanding who are the people that are feeding their business. So where is all the money coming from? And then formulating a story about what do you do? How long have you been doing it? And I'll get letters from different people that are actually providing them work, so that when I present it to the bank, that the bank have comfort in knowing that when we give this person money, we're not putting them in any trouble. And I think a lot of people think the banks are mean, and actually all they're trying to do is keep them safe. You know, like they'll go, oh, but I've got this big deposit, so why can't I borrow that much money? And it's like, well, if the deposit's great, that's magnificent, but to be able to pay the loan back, your income's got to support that. And so I get back to the real basics where I go, okay, if I get someone coming in, they usually want to know how much is it going to cost me. So I go, okay, well, this is the home loan cost. Then on top of this, we've got rates and insurance. So I just try and break everything down. I did a really cute thing years ago. I went into one of my kids' schools, and all these young kids have got all these plans on what they want to do. And a lot of people aren't really financially savvy. So I went to the supermarket and got a whole pile of newspapers, and I handed it out to all the kids and said, right, we're going flatting. Find me a flat. So they're trawling through the papers and they're telling me how much their flat's going to cost. And then it's like, okay, who's got a car? Okay, so here's the cost of typically running a car with insurance and stuff. And I just took them through basic cost of living, your power bill, your phone bill, your internet, your food, your rent. And when they got to the end of it, and obviously we were looking at incomes as well, they're like, ooh. Actually, I think we might stay home with mom and dad for a bit longer and save a little bit more money.
Mm.
And it's like, wow, you know, like somewhere and somehow we seem to have lost the ability to understand the real basics, you know?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I don't know if it's a new thing. I just think it's, well, I mean, everyone's getting richer. I mean, people, you see people talking, oh no, what horrible time to be alive. But fundamentally, the poverty lines, you know, a lot of people are escaping poverty, a lot of people are getting access to water, internet, food. So it is a rise. And I guess gone are the days where, you know, say your great-great-grandmother, you'd have one meat once a month because it's all you could afford, and then you rationed out things because the cost of acquiring the things you need to support yourself, and maybe you spend 6 hours trying to wash your clothes, and you can only have one person at home, so you only got one income. I think the value of money, you know, and the value of having a comfortable life is diminishing. I think instant gratification and the access to everything you ever wanted in life easily at your fingertips, it's probably taught people that money is too boring, let's not think about it. But what do you think about the psychology of spending? Because you obviously do a lot with people getting to a financial position to get a house.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it's not an income thing, it's a behavioral thing. You know, you could
absolutely
earn $500,000 a year and not save anything. So what do you go through to help someone start saving better?
Well, that's sort of actually quite interesting what you talked about, because I tell you something, because this is a long time that I've been doing this, so this is my 21st year coming, I've seen mum and dad, and then I've seen the kids, you know, as they're coming through and looking to buy. And what I can notice is that we are so fundamentally role models to our children, because if mum and dad have got what the banks term, or used to term, an appetite for debt, so they want to just get everything now. They don't want to wait. They don't want to save. They're just going to go and tick it all up. And then you look at the amount of money that they've got left over as a family at the end of it for the stuff that they've bought, and that they're struggling. They don't have a lot. And then you see the children, and they follow the same. They follow the same. So it becomes like it's passed down through the generations. So then you see other people that are careful, and then you see their children, and they are the same. So if I had someone that had a deemed appetite for debt, they'd come to me and their statement of position shows Afterpays, Zip Pays, lay-bys, credit cards, stuff like that. I would talk to them about the consequences of that and how it can be perceived or seen. And then I would look at it and I would make a plan for them, because actually I do want to see them succeed. So I'd be looking at all their debts and I'd be going, okay, so let's work out which is the most expensive. And I'll actually work with them to minimize and get that down and let them see the consequences of what they're doing. And some people are just magnificent because they look, they understand, they listen, and they make change. And then you see them succeed. It could take them 6 months. It could take them 2 years.
Mm.
But that's okay.
I could see them try, like a better word, trying to please you in a sense, try to do right by you. So if let's say you invest, the more time you invest and you take a lot of time to understand their situation, to try and help them, to be of service, line up all those people in advance, book it all in, and investing hugely into them and their goal. So they've got, I would call, like a relationship debt, where they're like, oh my God, she's done so much and she hasn't even been paid yet, because she only gets paid when the mortgage, you know, gets sorted. Or maybe you charge for a plan, not sure. We can ask that. And then you bring awareness. So they're like, okay, we're aware of the problem, so we can't deny it. And now you've got that relationship debt. So they want to live up to the expectation you have of them. How do you find it once they leave? Like, let's say you weren't allowed to be there. You could only talk to them once. And you had to ask them questions to help them realize themselves. How would you get them to get into their own house just from a one conversation?
Well, they've got to step up and take responsibility for their own behavior and their own actions. So I would scribble all over their application forms, and I would give them my opinion on how I would actually get that debt reduction down, and then off they go. And it could be that we'll make a plan to touch base in 3 or 4 months' time, how you're doing. And then they might just update that statement of position for me so I can see how well they've been paying down the debts. So if they need a cheerleader and an encourager, I can definitely be that. But at the end of the day, they've still got to have the ears to listen, and they've still got to have the mindfulness or the willpower to execute the suggestion.
Mm.
Yeah, I see so many successes. Honestly, I've got so many people that I'm incredibly proud of.
That's cool.
And I don't mind. I mean, if your focus is customer-based and customer service and, you know, people come in, I mean, they might take my advice and then go directly to the bank or go to another broker. I mean, that's entirely up to them. But if I've been an aid to them getting where they want to be, then that's cool. Because I also believe in what goes around comes around. So if your focus is on, you know, helping people, I'm not doing it just because I'm going to get paid for it. You know what I mean? That's not my focus.
Mm. I think that approach is one of the most successful if you can get past that first hump. So I would call it more of a farmer approach. You know, the caring, relationship heavy, doing the best you can for a person. I'd be curious how you manage that with activity, because a lot of people that are really nice often might not have the most self-worth, so they're over nice. That happens sometimes. So they compensate by being really nice and don't ask for enough money, don't push the sale hard enough, that sort of thing. So what sort of activities do you attest to your success over the last 21 years? Are you talking to intermediaries a lot? Are you have a frequency of talking to clients? What have you found has been quite helpful for growing your business?
Just being customer focused, not focused on revenue. Just genuinely being customer focused. But I think people can, they get a sense when they're talking to anybody, whether or not they can see that there's actually a genuine passion for what they do. And I think if you're enthusiastic, if you believe in what you're doing and you believe that you can be of benefit or help to somebody, if you actually believe in yourself first, then I think most people enjoy their time with me, to be honest. And a lot of people consider me their friend at the end of it, because I think you can smell a rat, you know, like you can smell if somebody is there for you genuinely, or whether they've got other, whether there's another agenda sitting there.
Mm.
Yeah. And I'm so easy breezy. I mean, when people come in, I've got a lot of information over a long period of time that I can give them that that will assist them with the purchase of a home. I don't know. I think you've just got to focus on doing the best and being the best you can.
Were there call, like, so let's say 21 years ago you start, you're like, oh my God, I don't know anyone. So you can't really be customer focused. We might know a few people, but it's hard to be customer focused if no one rings. So did you have partnerships? Did you door knock? Did you cold call? Did you pamphlets? Did you hit up your friends? What was your first?
Oh my gosh. In the early days, yes. Okay. You don't have the phone ringing.
Yeah.
And I cringe at some of, you know, the, some of the things that I did, and it was never based off being a mischievous person or a bad person. It was just naivety. It was not knowing in gratefulness. So yes, I would be dropping pamphlets. I would be, you know, paying for, I don't know if there was lead generation back then the same, but, you know, like promoting yourself, definitely. But I'm in an extremely privileged position, and I know that, you know, I'm incredibly grateful for everyone that supports my business. But, you know, my customers are just so beautiful because, you know, the nicest thing they can do for me is actually leave me a review and just say how they find me, because that's an honest, organic representation of my business. And then the people that believe in me, the agents, the directors, you know, solicitors, accountants, you know, past customers, I'm hugely, hugely grateful.
Has there been like
for the support that I get?
Well, that's good. Yeah, it's good to have be surrounded by people that care. Is there a partnership or a strategy that was fruitful early on? So you partnered with real estate agents or your accountants or lawyers. What was the first, like, okay, if I just keep being genuine, getting to know these people, it's a great source of business? Or what was your first realization? Oh, wow, I can get business doing this.
I think it was realizing that in business, your most valuable tool in business is forming relationships, and they need to be genuine. So I understand when I speak to, I call them my bankers. I actually enjoy talking to them. And, you know, we'll not just talk about business. We could talk about something that's going on in our life, you know, like I'm genuinely interested in them and vice versa. And same with, you know, some of the lawyers that I deal with. It's like, I'm genuinely interested in the person. And if you want to be good in business, you need to understand that relationships are paramount everywhere.
Hmm.
And treat people with the utmost respect, actually. You know, like you might have, I might have somebody that most people would look sideways at because they're on low income, or they might have something about them that would suggest that they're not a good candidate for a home loan. I'm trying not to be awful, you know, because perceptions, people can be quite judgmental. And they overlook how beautiful the person is and how beautiful the family are behind them and the family support that person has. I mean, I've seen young people on minuscule income that have come across my desk, and most people, if you are hungry and money focused and not person or relationship orientated, would overlook just the, you know, what you have there. And if I can remember being told once to focus on revenue, money. So focus on getting really big mortgages across the line and all the rest of it, which blows my mind, because that is the opposite to what I would ever want to do in my business. And then I've helped people with little weeny tiny mortgages, and then they talk to their friends about how nice or wonderful they found my services. And then before you know it, you know, like it's so small-minded, you know, like I never focus on money when I look at a customer, and I always give them respect because it's a person. Why shouldn't I?
Well, I think the most valuable thing in the world is relationships. It compounds, you know, spiritually, emotionally, financially. I mean, we are humans after all. We have whites in our eyes because we need to be able to interpret each other's emotions and understand each other. Our whole life is people. And it's quite crazy, yeah, to be that short-sighted, narrow-minded. I do think you also need to have a certain level of business acumen in the way you target, but turning someone away because they're not your kind of person, I think it's a big failing. Just strategically, it's purely for the fact that this person's going to talk and tell other people. You know, the amount of people I met in Auckland that know someone I know. And I was talking to someone not long ago. They all worked in the same business, three independent people. I met them independently, worked at the same business, and had a horrible experience. And they all corroborated this story. And now that's just out. So they're telling me, they're not, I probably won't say the name of company, so it probably stops at me, but they're spreading all the way. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't make sense strategically, and it doesn't make sense from being a good person and even for you emotionally. So it's kind of crazy that people don't do it. So why do you think people got that commission breath? Why are they just trying to get their own personal gain?
I don't know. I think that would be an individual, because that would be me trying to walk in someone else's shoes and imagine how that person would be. And all I can do is imagine. But I think when you've got, you know, if you're not worried about, you know, where the next dollar's coming from, so if you feel comfortable in your role as a professional, and you know you've got the income to sustain you, I think a lot of people in the early days, where especially if you're commission based, every sale is so important. You know, because they need it. They've still got to live as well. And I think maybe you can make poor decisions if you're in that place. But if you're in a place where you're not worried about where the next dollar's coming from, so you're in an established business that you've obviously been doing well with, you take the time, because you don't have the anxiety. Oh my gosh, I've got to make the sale work because I need. So, because then you're focused on yourself, aren't you? It's what I need.
Mm. Do you think?
And you can't be. You need to be able to focus outside of yourself.
Yeah. How do you maintaining integrity in the face of adversity is quite hard. I sort of see humans as great white sharks, and maybe that's, you know, some trauma or whatever, but if they're well fed, they're fine. Well fed emotionally, financially, or in a relationship, or but when they're faced with adversity or hunger, you know, the morality, they become ambiguous with their morality. So as someone that, you know, has been living in a tent or spent my last money on a tie to get a job and commission those sales and had to pull it off while still, you know, acting with integrity, I think financially I can be okay to still do the right thing. But how do you stop yourself thinking of yourself when your back's against the wall and you haven't got sales, the mortgage payment's due, the kids rely on you or whatever? How do you maintain integrity in the face of adversity?
I could only say what I would do. You know, I would hope that I would be not so proud to do anything. Yeah, I'd probably, if I was in that place, I would be better working in a PAYE role and not putting the pressure of being, I think it's understanding your limitations. Being honest with yourself about what your capacity is, your capabilities are. Are these responsibilities something that I can carry on my shoulders? You know, or is it going to tip me over? I mean, I've had times in my life where I can remember starting a cleaning business when my children were little, and my mum used to do cleaning, and I can remember sitting as a PA to the general manager of, you know, different companies, and, you know, like, oh my gosh, you know, like cleaning. Well, yeah, I ran a cleaning business, and I can remember cleaning a bathroom while somebody came into a hairdressing salon and going, oh, hi, and sort of feeling a little bit embarrassed. But at the time, I had small children and I was trying to build a business where I could still take care of my children if they were sick. So it's been adaptable, isn't it? And not letting ego. Mm. I think ego is not necessarily our friend.
No, agree. It's interesting. Humility maintains integrity. Yeah. Yeah, it's probably fair. It's like, you know, the writing's on the wall. It's clear that either the business isn't successful and you shouldn't go to the casino and gamble $20,000 to try and pull it out of the bag. And yeah, so how, in terms of that self-awareness piece, because, you know, I have a big ego and I'm like, oh, I could pull it off. And even though I've gone to zero quite a few times and I'll just keep going it because I don't want to work for anyone else ever again. How what's your process to keep yourself in check to be like, hey, ego, whoa, Black Betty, what's your strategy?
It's a real simple question. And I say this to my girls. I've got four girls and I listen to them at times and shake my head because I'm not a sycophant. I will tell them what I think, you know, like I will honestly tell them. They may not like hearing it, but I don't know. I would say to the girls, how would you feel if that was done to you? How would you feel if somebody said that to you? And if it sits comfortably within you, that this behavior would be acceptable to me, then that's a nice sort of guide, isn't it? Because if you treat others how you want to be treated, surely that would help our egos, unless we've got a distorted, you know, like I'm assuming that we're talking about a relatively healthy person here.
You come across some unhealthy ones, gosh.
Yeah, yeah. So just treat people how you want to be treated. Speak to someone how you'd like to be spoken to.
It's crazy that anytime you talk to someone that's successful in some genre of life, they don't necessarily say new things. They just do what we're meant to do. You know what I mean? It's simple. Like if you care about your customers and you put their interests first and you have a high enough activity and you're consistent at it. And another interesting thing that I learned from you was I always think in sales, like the close has to be simple. And the limiting, at least the bottleneck from what I've seen in mortgages and don't know anything about apart from our chat, is that they're motivated to buy. So the problem isn't the motivation and it's trying to, you know, build expectation or want. It's the execution. So what you're doing is you're laying out all the barriers that could come into their way and committing with a maximum amount of effort. And some people will say, well, that's a misguided use of effort. You've got a limited amount of time. But what I imagine that would do is lead to more successful settlements, which is probably why you're in the top 10% in your aggregate. But what would be your closing remarks for any young person that has the challenges you've had in life, or a young mortgage broker trying to find their way into this world? What's your advice?
So who are we talking about? Are we talking about a person or somebody that's wanting to start a business?
Talking about you. You're talking to yourself. That will probably help someone else that's listening because they have a similar story.
If I was talking to myself, I'd be going, come on, baby, we've got this. Just be prepared to turn up every day and be prepared to work hard, be humble enough to listen and learn, surround yourself with like-minded people. So, you know, I really love modeling, and that's copying people that I think are successful. I remember speaking to, I won't mention his name, but it's somebody that's been in the business for a little bit longer than me. And he was the top broker in Australasia, New Zealand and Australia. And I said to him, how do you become a good broker? He said to me, write mortgages. I said, come on, seriously. You know, like, how do I become a good broker? He said, write mortgages. Time on the tools, just get out there and do it. And be customer focused first. So get out of yourself, get away from yourself. But you've got to learn, educate, educate, educate. Keep relevant. Be humble and be kind. Be nice.
Well, it's been very kind of you to join us on this podcast. So thank you.